Thank you, Jared. Well, I am at an advantage over you. I have to stand up after lunch. And therefore, the odds of my falling asleep are slimmer than yours. But we will see how we do. We're talking about the shaping power, and we left off talking about the communal aspect of seeking to be formed in ways that are appropriate to those of disciples of Jesus, seeking to be attentive in a world that is increasingly distracted and inattentive. And I really do believe that there are great opportunities for the church in a digital age, particularly in terms of our use of technology in ways that are different. There is an opportunity for Christians to be known as people who really listen to other people. There is an opportunity for followers of Christ to use technologies in ways that are redemptive, by which I mean, yes, means of communicating the gospel, but in our class we also talk about the redemptive use of technology with respect to the broader sense of redemption, where there are some very wonderful uses of technology that temporarily and partially work at the reversing of certain aspects of the fall. So one of the things that we do in the class is we look at some of the uses of something like virtual reality and how there is technology being employed in that regard that is showing very promising signs of effectiveness in terms of treating people with PTSD, various forms of phobias through exposure therapy that is making use of virtual reality. And Christians should be thinking about how is it that we can use, create technology in ways that are affirming of humanity, that is not dehumanizing. It is an interesting phenomenon, if you think about it, that we are very, very fascinated by machines that seem to mimic humanity while being somewhat dulled by other humans. Or how it is that we assign personification to various forms of technology while using machine-like language to describe ourselves. There's a lot of interest going on there. But I wanted to say more about this idea of the corporate dimension. And that is going to get us into the discussion of wisdom and some of the practical ways to stem the tide of just uncritically being caught up into the current of the way the culture relates to technology. Let's see. I don't know what I'm doing wrong here. I'm pointing up. And yes, it has ceased to be a click. Now, okay. I was ready to assign, rethink some of my moral stuff about tone. Okay, thank you, Jared. This is a an article that appeared in Christianity Today. Do you want this? Okay, thanks. Christianity Today, not long ago. It's written by a woman named Bonnie Christian, and it's called The Spiritual Battle of Teen Screen Time. Thank you. Kids' addictions to their phones isn't a legislative issue. It's a discipleship one. And in the article, which I think you can access online, I don't think you have to pay for this one if you're not a subscriber. She says some really interesting things, and there is a lot of research that has been done and a lot of studies that are showing that there are some adverse effects with teens, particularly with cell phones, and especially emotionally with young women, social media particularly. Some of the people who have written in this area are Jean Twenge, a psychologist in California who wrote a book called iGen, and then her more recent book is called Generations. And then another author by the name of Jonathan Haidt. Jonathan Haidt is the co-author of a book called The Coddling of the American Mind. He is a social scientist who teaches at NYU, and he has a book coming out in March called The Anxious Generation: How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness. And he is an advocate of phone-free schools and things like that for a variety of reasons. Interesting thing about Jonathan Haidt, another interesting thing is that he is an atheist. But he is not a belligerent one. He is, I've always appreciated the things that he has written and the manner in which he has comported himself with respect to others, and I've heard him interact with even Christians and in a very respectful way. But in terms of his social science research, it is very, very, I think, valuable, but also in many respects alarming. But I want you to hear some of the things that Bonnie Christian has to say in this article. And she talks about how it is, in order to deal with phone addiction for teens, that one option is you can refuse to give your teenager a smartphone. But she says, but refusing to give your teenager a smartphone, let alone taking one away after you've given it, is nowhere near simple. It's what social scientists call a collective action problem. As social psychologist Jonathan Haidt has explained, if you could ban every teenager from smartphones and social media, they'd all be better off. But if you can ban only your kid, she'll almost certainly fare worse than before, because what you've effectively done is grounded her from half or more of her social life. Technically, it's not a punishment, but it will still feel like one. She'll miss all the inside jokes and spontaneous hangouts and the constant casual turn of hum of the group chat. The inevitable charge that you're being mean and ruining my life and exasperating me, Ephesians 4 was a go-to verse in my teenage years, will actually be pretty fair. That's a lot to miss. And in the article, she goes on and she says, well, the answer isn't legislation, and the answer isn't just a matter of doing this on an individual basis, but I want you to hear some of her concluding thoughts. This brings us to the church. Unlike the federal government, a local congregation is small enough that a no smartphones for kids agreement can be realistically implemented and enforced. And of course, there are no constitutional constraints on this kind of voluntary communal rule of life. And unlike a single family, a local congregation is big enough that parents wouldn't be left to tackle this problem alone, and teenagers wouldn't be isolated from a social center all their friends enjoy. Of course, this kind of congregational pact wouldn't be a panacea. Most of us have friends and family outside our local church, which means many parents would still have to contend with competing norms among school friends, cousins, neighbors, and so on. It would also require a seriousness about committing to a church-wide standard of behavior that many congregations simply do not have. Legalist, fundamentalist, Luddite, you'd hear it all, because this is a legitimately difficult proposal in our culture. That difficulty is exactly why it's worth considering. A congregational smartphone policy is a very 21st century way to carry each other's burdens and do good to all people, especially to those who belong to the family of believers, Galatians 6, 2, and 10. But the novelty of the burden makes it no less heavy. These little ones need help to bear it. Like many spiritual disciplines, the local church could be uniquely positioned to offer that help. Now, my point in reading this is not necessarily to say this is what we as local congregations need to do. But I want you to see that what she is trying to do is to get beyond the level of the individual or even the individual family. And she's saying, if we are going to walk wisely, it is going to require our corporate cooperation. We have to think together about what practices we are going to employ together so as to enforce and reinforce what is, in many respects, something that is very countercultural. And so what ideally I want to have cultivated in my own life and what it is that I desire to see come about in the students that I teach this class to and what it is that we know God desires for his people is that we would grow in wisdom. And that wisdom would be translated in terms of the decisions that we make whether and how to use various technologies. J.I. Packer, in his book, Knowing God, describes wisdom or defines wisdom as the power to see and the inclination to choose the best and highest goal together with the surest means of attaining it. So wisdom is not simply a matter of knowing certain things, though knowledge of some kind is necessary in order to live wisely. Wisdom has an ethical component. Wisdom is a matter of discernment as to not only what is permissible, but what is best. What is the highest goal, and what are the means by which we seek to arrive at it? That's what I meant earlier about it is the sign of immaturity to simply ask, is this permissible? But it is the sign of maturity to ask, is this profitable? Is this the best decision to make? Now, you can be very intelligent in terms of knowledge, but still be a fool. Because the fool in the Bible, particularly in Proverbs, is not one who is necessarily stupid in terms of cognitive ability or academics. The fool is one who is at heart defiant. And he or she is defiant of the order of creation that revolves around God, and in which God is paramount. The fool is the one who says, I will not submit myself to this order. I am going to forge a way on my own. In order to illustrate it to students, I say the fool is the one who plunges his head beneath water and takes a deep breath, thinking to himself, I can breathe underwater, and I will. There is a refusal to acknowledge the way things are and to conform oneself to them. And that's not so just in the physical realm, as the example that I used, but in the moral realm. And so Proverbs reminds us repeatedly that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. There is a book. This is one of the required texts that we use in the class. It's by a man named Samuel James. And it is called Digital Liturgies, Rediscovering Christian Wisdom in an Online Age. And James has a lot to say about wisdom, what it is, and how it is that life online can obscure wisdom. So I wanted to share some of his thoughts with you. He says, the essence of true wisdom is to live fully aligned with ultimate reality, practical, ethical, and theological. To the extent that anyone is wise, he sees himself, the world around him, and God for what they truly are. So wisdom is recognizing what is real, what is true, and bringing oneself in alignment with that. We know that God, through his word, has given us revelation concerning what ultimate reality is. And he calls us to bring ourselves in conformity by the power of the Spirit to the way things actually are, to resist the temptation to craft reality according to our own liking and to try to live accordingly. Not only because that does not glorify him, but that is detrimental to us. I was reading through Proverbs recently, and I was thinking how, to some extent, it is fair to say that biblical wisdom is an appropriate form of self-care. Because there is always this refrain, for example, if you are wise, if you are kind, you benefit yourself, Proverbs says. Lady Wisdom, the personification of wisdom in Proverbs, is calling at the gates of the city, seeking to be heard over the din and the commotion, and she's saying to the simple, come in and eat what I have prepared. You read through the book of Proverbs and you see that wisdom is presented as that which is really good for us, and if you spurn wisdom, you hate yourself, Proverbs says. This is why the father, the author of Proverbs, is pleading with his son, value wisdom above everything else. In all you're getting, get wisdom. There isn't anything that is more beneficial, of greater worth than wisdom. And so there is this idea that wisdom is to recognize and to submit to reality as God has created and revealed it. But James goes on to say, to the degree that our tools not only alter how we experience God's world, but begin to distort it, they become something other than tools, they become idols. So if our tools distort the world or our perception of the way that things actually are, then he says they have become idols. And then he looks at one of the ways that this distortion can take place. He says, in the online age, our default is to lose touch with reality. Left to ourselves and our machines, we find that wisdom often looks foolish, virtue often looks evil, and God often feels invisible. Every person living in a modern, digitally connected culture is constantly inhabiting a moral and intellectual habitat that distorts the biblical story of reality. And one of the primary ways that he says that this distortion takes place is with respect to a part of the reality that we are to acknowledge and to exalt in, that we are embodied. We are embodied, limited creatures. And that is good. The Christian story, the biblical story, knows nothing of disparaging materiality, physicality, embodiment. But when God created humanity with our finitude, our limitations, and our enfleshment, he said, it is very good. And the tendency that we have is to not agree with him in that regard, to see embodiment as something maybe to be tolerated, but certainly not something to really, really revel in. And one of the ways that this takes place in terms of our immersion in digital life is this. He says, our creaturely design is divinely ordered, something to inspire worship, gratitude, and joy. Biblically speaking, it's when we attempt to get around or beyond our identity as embodied creatures that we plunge headlong into despair and folly. Historically, in the second century AD, you may be aware of a heresy that arose called Gnosticism. The idea that the material world was intrinsically evil, that spirit was intrinsically good, and that there was this conflict between the two. Gnosticism regarded the body as that which had to be endured, but which ultimately we were seeking to be free from. That is so anti-biblical, it's not funny. But we can easily slip into it. But the incarnation of the Lord Jesus Christ, the Word taking on flesh, was one of the highest ways that God affirmed his delight in stuff, what he had made. And this is why some people denied that Christ had come in the flesh, because it was inconceivable to them that deity would in any way associate itself, let alone wed itself to matter, the body. So how is it that digital life can and often does obscure this goodness of being embodied? James goes on and he says, the internet, which dominates our lives as the primary medium through which we encounter most of the world. I want you to just really think about that, because he's not saying this is the case for every individual, but increasingly there is truth to this. The internet is the primary medium through which we encounter most of the world, is an entirely disembodied habitat. Consequently, the internet trains our consciences to think of ourselves and the world in disembodied ways. We do not exist bodily online, but through photos and videos that we carefully manipulate to construct a preferred identity. On social media, our community is not a room full of people physically present whom we can reach out and touch, but a collection of usernames and avatars and timelines. This habitat itself tells us a story that humans are not essentially people with flesh and blood, voices and facial expression, but users whom we can sufficiently know from their words, profile pictures, and shares. He is not saying that we don't know that people are actually embodied. What he's saying is we get trained to kind of see embodiment as almost peripheral, optional, not really necessary to know and enjoy another. And in this process, we can lose sight of the goodness, even the preference of being embodied. Now, to illustrate that, I want you to watch something. And this is Mark Zuckerberg announcing the change of name of Facebook to Meta. And you're probably, or some of you may remember, all of the fervor that surrounded that, because Mark Zuckerberg was really excited about the metaverse. The ability for people through virtual reality technology to connect with other people in situations simulating actually being there, and they could do work collaboration and play games and so forth. But I want you to listen to his verbiage in this announcement, particularly what he has to say about being connected and the body. So I think you're going to have to play that, and we'll stop at 3:07. Or can you play it?
It's technology.
Yeah, that's right. Well, let me see if, oh no, I can't do anything here. All right, you know what we're gonna do? You can do it? All right. Everybody look at Jared. Can you get the URL?
I believe the metaverse is the next chapter for the internet. And it's the next chapter for our company, too. So I've been thinking a lot about what this means for our company and who we are as we embark on this journey. We're a company that focuses on connecting people. While most other tech companies focus on how people interact with technology, we focus on building technology so people can interact with each other. One of the reasons I started Facebook was that at the time you could use the internet to find almost anything. Information, news, movies, music, shopping, except for the thing that matters most of all, people. Today, we are seen as a social media company. But in our DNA, we are a company that builds technology to connect people. And the metaverse is the next frontier, just like social networking was when we got started. Facebook was born in a specific time and place, a college campus, the web. It was what we could build at the time to put people back into our experience of technology. But connecting people was always much bigger. From way earlier on, I remember sitting in middle school classes, sketching in my notebooks, ideas that I wanted to code when I got home. And even though I didn't have the skill or technology to build it yet, it was always clear that the dream was to feel present with the people we care about. Isn't that the ultimate promise of technology? To be together with anyone, to be able to teleport anywhere, and to create and experience anything? Yet here we are in 2021, and our devices are still designed around apps, not people. The experiences we're allowed to build and use are more tightly controlled than ever. And high taxes on creative new ideas are stifling. This is not the way that we are meant to use technology. The metaverse gives us an opportunity to change that if we build it well. But it's going to take all of us, creators, developers, companies of all sizes. Together, we can finally put people at the center of our technology and deliver an experience where we are present with each other. Together, we can create a more open platform with more ways to discover experiences and more interoperability between them. And together, we can unlock a massively bigger creative economy. I know the internet story isn't straightforward. Every chapter means new voices and new ideas, and yes, there will be challenges and risks and disruption of established interests. But there will also be opportunities and benefits that we can't even imagine yet. For connection, for creation, for learning, and joy, we'll all need to work together from the beginning to bring the best possible version of this future to life. A future where, with just a pair of glasses, you will be able to step beyond the physical world and into the kinds of experiences that we have talked about today. I've been thinking a lot about...
Okay, we can... So thank you very much for working your magic there, Jared. Notice what Zuckerberg says. He wants us to believe that what really concerns him is putting people at the heart of things, and that technology is a means for connecting us. But I don't know if you followed any of the specific terminology that he used, but he sees technology as a means for us to be present with people, where presence does not require embodiment. And at the end, he says that we will be able to go beyond the physical and virtually be with anyone, anywhere. That is not a biblical view of embodiment. Because Mark Zuckerberg sees embodiment as something that needs to be transcended. It is something that really is optional to really knowing someone. And I'm not meaning to impute negative motives. I just think he's mistaken in terms of the place that he gives embodiment and presence to real connection. He sees connection as being just as good if it is disembodied as if it is embodied. And that is one of the ways that the digital world can obscure wisdom. Where in our habituation and acclimation to it, we buy into the idea that really relationship and connectedness doesn't really require embodiment. And in fact, embodiment is an impediment of sorts. It's something to be overcome. And that is what James is getting at in his book. So one of the things that Proverbs says about wisdom is that wisdom is a corporate affair. If you want to grow in wisdom, you need to be around wise people. As we are seeking to be followers of Jesus Christ as his body, the pursuit and the cultivation of wisdom is not to be done in isolation. Certainly, there is a place for personal prayer, Bible reading, and so forth. I'm not discounting that. But the Bible is clear that growing in wisdom requires rubbing shoulders with wise people. Your company is going to have an impact upon your character. So the companion of fools will suffer harm. I want to direct your attention to some resources that I think are helpful in helping us think more about this idea of wisdom, particularly as it relates to the subject matter that we're talking about today. This is a book that is on the list. It's written by Brett McCracken, and it is called The Wisdom Pyramid: Feeding Your Soul in a Post-Truth World. And some of you may recall the food pyramid. The food pyramid was intended to illustrate graphically the proportion of various kinds of food groups that your diet should include in order for you to experience optimal nutrition and health. And so Brett McCracken is using this as the guide. And I'll show you, I don't know how well you can read that, but this is describing what he thinks is proportionally what a life of wisdom is like. The base, and by proportionally, he's not first and foremost saying necessarily time spent, though that might come into it, but he's just saying this is what you should be making priorities in the order of these things. The base being the scriptures. There is no establishing of wisdom apart from God's revelation. And so he has there the Bible, our daily bread, that there is a continual feeding upon the words of scripture individually and corporately, and that that is the foundation upon which a wise life is to be built. Above that, the church. The fellowship of the local church, on the left there, he has embodied rhythms and worship. Wise people in a physical place. Proximity. Closeness. That this is part of what it means to be the church. That we are gathering. Ecclesia means assembly. We have gone through a whole lot, particularly since 2020, that has made us rethink the nature of the church. And as far as I know, the church is still an assembly that requires being together, proximity, wise people interacting with each other. But then under church, that's the local church, there is the universal church and the church across time. And so he has their time-tested theology. Wise people in Christian history. When Ephesians says that God has given to the church some to be pastors and teachers, we should not read that as it's only a reference to our time, but God has given the gift of teachers and pastors, wise people, to the church across time. And so making the ingestion of things like the story of Christians from ages past, the theological deliberations and reflections of those who have gone before us, the theological reflection of contemporary believers who are in other parts of the world. So we want to give emphasis to the local church, but we don't want to neglect the historic church. The church did not begin with us. We are part of a long line of believers. And it is to our detriment that we do not avail ourselves of the resources that brothers and sisters from ages past have produced. And then the next level of the pyramid has to do with creation, nature, and beauty. Get outside, he says. General revelation. General revelation is the knowledge of God that is mediated through what he has made. Paul deals with it in Romans 1. The psalmist in Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God. There is something about being in the presence of God's creation in terms of nature that is rejuvenating and that inspires worship, gratitude for the given, by which he means the givenness of nature. But by beauty, he has in mind natural beauty as well as created beauty. Beholding, contemplating, creating works of beauty, enjoying and making art, observation and attentiveness. I was reading a New York Times article to our students in this class a few days ago, and it was about walking while on the phone. And some of the physiological and psychological, emotional effects of it, and made reference to a study that was done with respect to walking outside has generally been seen as something that is really beneficial, not only physiologically, but emotionally. But there have been studies that have shown that walking outside while on your phone can leave you with a more sour mood and more distressed. You may still be walking outside, but you're walking outside distracted. You're walking outside not really attentive to your environment. And then the next level, he says, books. More old books than new, great books, and a broad array of topics. Literacy and the place of reading, not only of scripture, but other forms of literature, has long been a mark of Christianity. Where Christianity has gone, literacy has followed, and that has largely been in order to expose people to the scriptures. But there is a great benefit to just reading broadly, and I would include even fiction in that, because fiction can have the effect of illustrating aspects of the human condition in concrete forms in very poignant ways. And you'll notice that as we move towards the top, and things start to narrow down, the next level is the internet. And there, he says, Google and Wikipedia only as needed. Focus on trusted sources. Prioritize content recommended by wise people. Don't just look at what appears at the top of the list, because the algorithms are at work there as well. And so it is wrong to think, well, if something comes up to the top, that must mean it's more reliable. Focus on trusted sources. One of the books that are that's on the list that I highly recommend is by the woman that I showed you the CT article from, Bonnie Christian. She is a journalist. And she wrote a book called Untrustworthy. And it's not just about news, but she says that she believes that we are, as at least in the American society, in what she calls an epistemological crisis, that we don't know what is true, we don't know what to believe, and we are being fed, tailor-made sources of information, which, as we discussed earlier, makes it much more difficult for us to have fruitful interaction with each other, because unlike the case with the newspapers, our sources are so splintered and varied. And that should be of concern to Christians, because as the last few years have shown, that kind of dissension and splintered and fracturedness has invaded the church in ways that are abominable. And some of that is due to the fact that we are shaped and fed things differently. And it's disruptive of our unity. And then the pinnacle, but not because it's most important, social media. I guess in the next iteration of this book, the bird will be gone and an X will be there. But use social media sparingly. Learn to live without. Too much is bad for overall health. That is true. Social media has some great benefits, but it becomes destructive when we try to do on social media what it cannot do. And there are some things that I just think Christians should not be trying to do on social media. There are some subjects that I just think it's not worth posting about. And certainly, trying to have substantive debate and discussion on social media, I think, is just a tremendous waste of time. There are some things about the medium itself that make it counterproductive for substantive communication. If you want to make use of social media with someone who is in your vicinity, use it to send them a direct message or something and say, let's get together for coffee and talk about this, rather than exchanging posts and links and so forth. There is not anything likely of profit that is going to come from that. In the book, Three Marks of Wisdom that he addresses, he talks about wisdom in an online world is going to look like discernment in a too much world. Too much in the sense of the inundation of information that is at our disposal. It calls for discernment. It calls for discernment not only with respect to what is true, but what is worth my time. I know that I have gotten caught up in rabbit trails, following links, for way too long and realize that this, I don't have much to show for this. And so discernment in a world that is just constantly pouring over us with new data, new information, clickbait. Wisdom is going to look like discernment, and it's going to say, you know what? This isn't valuable. Wisdom is also going to look like patience in a too fast world. One of the ways that we haven't spent a whole lot of time talking about, but one of the ways that we can be shaped by our habits online is, this is a medium that values speed. This is a medium that values quick responses. And wisdom, I mean, think about Proverbs, all that it has to say about a wise person who is restrained in his or her words, whereas the fool just gives full vent. The internet loves fools. And in many respects, fosters foolishness. And one of the things that we have to be conscientious about and helping one another to be conscientious about is resisting the urge to impulsively reply, respond, comment on something, and to maybe even call into question, you know what, I saw that you posted this, and I just had a question because the tone with which you said that just seemed kind of inappropriate. We have to be willing to be open to that kind of brotherly, sisterly correction, question, rather than taking offense. How dare you? And wisdom is going to look like humility in a too focused on me world. It is a challenge to try to make use of the internet in a way that is truly seeking to serve other people. And even beyond that, that is truly seeking to honor God. And so these are some of the marks of wisdom that Brett McCracken gets into in this book. I think that this is, especially for families, this is a very good book for addressing some of these things. It's not all about technology, but it is about the cultivation of wisdom. This lady is Sherry Turkle. Sherry Turkle is a psychologist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. One of her books is on the table back there, Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other. And she followed that up with this book, Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age. Again, Turkle is not a Christian, but I so appreciate what she says in this book. And I think that if you are involved in any kind of relationship, you should read it. That way I cover everything. Parent, marriage, pastor. This is what's interesting about her. She works at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. She has been studying the effects of computer technology on society for about 30 years. When she started, she was very optimistic about life online and so forth. But when she started, it was in the era of the desktop. And in the era of the desktop, you had to go to the desktop. You had to sign on, and you were there for a period of time, and then you left, and you did other things, and so forth. But with the miniaturization of computers, such that now you took your computer with you everywhere, and you could be connected pretty much all the time, she wrote Alone Together, and she said that with her first book, her book before Alone Together was her optimism about life online. And there's a TED Talk by her that you can find where she says, you know, when I wrote that book, it got me on the cover of Wired magazine, computer technology magazine. They were really rah-rahing it because she was so enthusiastic. She said, now I've written another book, Alone Together, that will not get me on the cover of Wired magazine. Because her enthusiasm was tempered and she was sounding a caution. And in her book, Reclaiming Conversation, she is looking at the effects of mediated communication on areas like education, romance, business. I forget all of the ones that she does. But in the book, she says this: people avoid face-to-face conversation but are comforted by being in touch with people, and sometimes with a lot of people who are emotionally kept at bay. So she says, we want to be connected, but we want to be connected controllably. And so the idea of being virtually connected is appealing, because it offers me a level of control that I desire. And she says in her TED Talk that across generations, so this isn't just a young person thing, she says, across generations, people tell me I'd rather text than talk. I would rather text someone than I would to actually have to talk to them face to face. I remember being at a ministerial meeting where a young minister who dealt with young men, he had a ministry to men, he said that he knew two guys who were college roommates who sent instant messages to each other while they were still in the room. And I started laughing. And he looked at me troubled. And he said, "I'm not joking." And I felt bad for laughing because he was rightly disturbed by the fact that these two young Christian men found it easier while being in the same room to deal with each other through that mediated means. And when I heard Sherry Turkle saying that, I thought, if anyone should be opposed to that, it should be us. Consider what John has to say at the end of his second and third letters, dealing with the technology of his day, pen and ink. "Though I have much to write to you, I would rather not use paper and ink. Instead, I hope to come to you and talk face to face so that our joy may be complete. I had much to write to you, but I would rather not write with pen and ink. I hope to see you soon, and we will talk face to face." We are people who affirm the incarnation. We are people who affirm the goodness of being embodied. We are people who long and look for, or at least we should be looking for, not just going to heaven, but the new heavens and the new earth, where we will be raised and glorified like Christ. If we fall into this same set of priorities, I think it's better to interact with each other in a form other than face-to-face. We are to be pitied. And we are not living out what it is that we confess in terms of what is good and what God's design is. We have to stop. But, oh no. Okay, there's another video. I'm gonna skip it. Huh? Yeah, I'm gonna skip it. Okay. All right. Okay, well, let me. Wait a minute. This is a commercial for Meta's Quest. Quest is a virtual reality game. Now, I want you to pay attention to this, especially with respect to what we've just been talking about, because this is what Meta put out. Well, just watch it, and then we'll talk about it.
Okay, Davey, good game.
You gonna be on tonight?
Yeah, definitely.
Cool, see you later.
Dear friend, my pal, best friend, who's
pass it, pass it! Do.
Yes! That's how it's done.
You wanna play one more after this?
Yeah, one more.
Yeah, I mean, actually, that was the first time I got my heart broken.
Well, she didn't deserve you, Vic.
Well, that got deep all of a sudden.
Bit nippy out.
So what?
Right there.
Be
got him.
Yeah!
Oi! Keep it down!
No, you keep it down!
Sorry, neighbors.
I know. I can't stand mine either.
Where were we?
Winning.
Oh, yes.
Let's get back to that.
Yeah, now this is the question. This is a good question. The amazement that that's actually a commercial trying to promote this game. In many respects, this is like satirical. This is like something you might expect to find on Saturday Night Live or something, poking fun at it. It's comical and tragic. We spend like 20 minutes, 25 minutes dissecting this commercial because there's so much going on in it. Though it's short, the music, friends, best friends, and so forth, the other people who are in their respective apartments while they're playing a game. One guy might be his roommate, the other might be a girlfriend, I don't know, but they're looking at them. Like, they are completely engaged with each other remotely and ignoring the people who are right there in their physical presence. And beyond that, they don't know each other, and they're not even aware of the fact that they're playing with each other, but they're neighbors. Because what is given priority is the interaction virtually. So I think that that is illustrative of so much of what we're talking about. I'm going to close, though. Yes, I am going to close with this. This is a book by Craig Gay. And it is called Modern Technology and the Human Future. Craig Gay is a Christian. And he says, and so we must ask, are our technologies enhancing ordinary embodied face-to-face relations, for example, by creating and or protecting time and space for them? Are our devices making these relations more vivid and meaningful? If they are, then we ought to use them with deep gratitude. If, for example, we find that our use of social media makes us more attentive to the needs of others, then wonderful. We should use it gratefully. Yet if we find instead that our technologies are undermining our ordinary embodied face-to-face relations with each other, then this should give us pause. It may be that technology is interposing itself between us, making our communication less fluid and our interaction less meaningful.